Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Mimi Ong couldn't fall asleep.
I probably tried to go to bed. I can't remember what time I went to bed. It might have been, you know, close to 9.
And for all Mimi cared, the dark space between her and her bedroom clock might as well have been just as far as where her mind was actually worrying, 140 million miles away.
I have to share with you, I don't know that I've shared publicly like this. I actually got quite emotional the night before when I actually got to prepare for the portion of if it didn't land properly.
It was a tiny vehicle, less than 4 pounds, and the where was on Mars.
This is the first time like it left our planet, right? So yeah, definitely it was a first of a kind mission. There's no manual pre-written. My name is Mimi Ong. I'm the former project manager for Ingenuity Mars Helicopter.
Time ticked by slowly.
I got quite emotional because I ended up walking through all our journey and what each success was. When we did our first, you know, proof of concept flight to when we really achieved the mass, and then we were put onto the rover, which was like incredible, right? Like our dream come true, like we were going to Mars, right? And then now we're at Mars and doing that, and how proud we were.
But the team still didn't know if the little copter could actually fly on Mars. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The night of April 18th, 2021, edged toward the first minute of April 19th, when suddenly Mimi's phone lit up.
And I think I remember around midnight, Bob Ballram texted me.
Mimi was the head of NASA's Ingenuity team. Ballaram was the team's chief engineer.
And I said, hey, Ingenuity should have flown by now. And because there was a time lapse. And now it was a few hours later that the telemetry was going to come back down. But around that time he texted me, he's like, yep, it should have flown by now. And I remember that text. And then, of course, then you drive in the dark and you get there, you're seeing people you haven't seen for a long time. It was really exciting. We were extremely conservative about COVID, so we hadn't seen each other. And in fact, it was the first time a lot of us had been back in the same room. So there was a lot of emotion charge there. But I still, after, you know, all the excitement, then I think it was very somber. It was pretty much like thinking and just kind of pacing, not so anxiously at that point, but still pacing and thinking about, you know, all the outcomes. And then the time came when the telemetry was going to come down.
This is downlink. Data products appear to be in. We will begin processing shortly.
And then I think it was Garrick next to me. I started moving around like a little bit and he started to see some telemetry. And I'm like, you know, trying to read his body language and everything.
This is downlink. We have pulled in data products from Mars 2020, confirming that we have helicopter data products, helicopter telemetry, helicopter events.
Rotor motors appear healthy. Swashplate servos appear healthy. Overall actuators appear healthy.
This is flight control, confirming that we have EVRs from Ingenuity. Ingenuity is reporting having performed spin-up, takeoff, climb, hover, descent, landing, touchdown, and spin down.
And then for me, the most exciting moment where I allowed myself to accept it, more than the video of the first flight that came down from Perseverance's camera, when I saw the altimeter plot.
Altimeter data confirms that Ingenuity has performed its first flight. The first flight of a powered aircraft to another planet.
Because you knew, right, when it was supposed to go up, you knew what the altitude should be, you know what the duration, and then you're looking at the jiggles like, oh, it's a really smooth glide, and then came back down perfectly. And I think that's when I say, I can jump, I can actually, you know, celebrate. That's it, yeah. That's where the geeky side comes out. I have to see that plot, you know, I can't celebrate on just, you know, it went up and it's flying, yeah. We can now say that human beings have flown a rotorcraft on another planet. Another thing that I haven't really spoken about, the adrenaline rush, I think it's really intense. So I remember after all the excitement and everybody, the room was empty and walking from one building to the other. I mean, I got really sick. And somebody says, oh, it's the adrenaline crash. It was an intense journey, right? Because every time, if we didn't demonstrate lift, we probably wouldn't have gone to the next step. If we didn't fly it, people might have said, well, another time, right? So every step, our team, we wouldn't allow ourselves to celebrate. And especially, I mean, Bob and I were not as bad, but like Hovard, Agrip, and Teddy Zanettos, and a lot of the team members, these are like, you know, like, let's not, we're not going to celebrate until the real thing, right? So it really was the first, I think it was feeling permission, like to actually celebrate. That teaming, the extraordinary, high engineering, highly technical, thinking together and working our way out of several places that we were stumped on, and the bond that we formed. I have to say that's, when I think back, it reinforces my belief that you can make really difficult things happen. And we did that. Our team was really connected that way because we never had to filter ourselves, you know, because it was so hard to do that we had the freedom. So I really, truly believe in teamwork and hard work and being very technical and objective to make things happen. I've said before, the sky is not the limit, meaning like really, you can really get things done. And I look at Ingenuity and the fact that now we don't have to wonder if it is possible to have missions that fly at Mars and to start using the aerial dimension for space exploration. That is a great thing to add to the arsenal of deep space exploration. But I think I look at this mission more personally. For me, it was ultimate reward to be in such a crazy team going for crazy thing, but being really razor focused together. It doesn't come all the time. You know, these are like magical team experience. And that's what I remember the most. And then Ingenuity rewarded us all, like with just this unexpected, like beyond our wildest dream performance.
Mimi Ong, she was the project manager of NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter. Now, beginning in April 19th, 2021, from that first success, Ingenuity's original mission was supposed to be a mere 5 flights total, little hops, to prove powered flight was possible on Mars. Well, the copter ended up making 72 flights. The mission was intended to be just 1 month long, but Ingenuity kept going for almost 3 years, covering more than 11 miles of the Martian surface. But on January 18th of this year, on its 72nd flight, Ingenuity damaged at least one rotor blade on touchdown. And NASA ended the copter's mission a short while later, but not without making this thrilling observation. Lori Glaze, director of NASA's Planetary Sciences Division, said, quote, "Ingenuity absolutely shattered our paradigm of exploration." Or, as you heard Mimi Ong put it a little bit earlier, humanity can still make difficult things happen. So what can the rest of us learn from the little copter that could? Well, joining us now is Teddy Zanettos. He served as the project manager for Ingenuity by the end of its mission. Teddy, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. Thank you for having me.
And also with us today is Hovard Grip. He served as the chief pilot of Ingenuity and led the development of its aerodynamics and flight control system. Hovard, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, let me just congratulate both of you and everybody that has been involved with the Ingenuity project. It really is an almost unimaginably awesome milestone in human exploration. So I just wanted to say that first and foremost. But Teddy, I mean, how are you feeling now? It must be more than a little bit bittersweet that Ingenuity is finally, so many years later, ended its mission.
Yes, I would say for the first 24 hours after we made the determination, we finally reached the end. It was a little bittersweet. But since then, we're on the Martian equivalent of Cloud Nine. It's really been a wonderful last couple of days. The team is still in communication with Ingenuity. She's still alive. We have this expression within the team, WENDY, which stands for We're Not Dead Yet. And we've had a great time collecting as much information as we can to try and piece together exactly what happened in that last flight. But it's also provided the team with an opportunity to get some perspective and really appreciate how lucky we've all been to be a part of Ingenuity. And what a marvelous journey this little aircraft has actually had.
Yeah. I think, was it just yesterday that that NASA released some pictures of where Ingenuity is right now, resting on a Martian dune somewhere, right?
Correct. We got some imagery from the Perseverance rover. Our team works very closely with the rover team, and we've been planning as soon as the rover got around a hill to take the best image we can from its vantage point of Ingenuity's resting spot, an area our internal helicopter team is calling Valinor Hills.
Okay. Now, Hovard, you're, of course, the person who flew Ingenuity around as the chief pilot. We'll talk a little bit later about how exactly that happens. But same question to you. Is it bittersweet? Do I dare ask if it almost feels like losing a member of your family after being so intimately involved with the project for so long?
You know, for me, I have to say it's mostly sweet. Yeah, a little bit bitter. But, you know, the mission had to end one way or another. And in a way, I think it ended the way it should have, with Ingenuity still pushing the limits. You know, that's how it went out, and that's how it should have gone out. And so, you know, I look back at this as just a huge success. And, you know, in terms of losing a member of your family, for me, you know, I admit I don't attach a personality to Ingenuity.
Okay.
To me, it's more about the team, you know, the team that built Ingenuity. That's what I look back on, you know, the experiences that we've had together, you know, being in the trenches together and making this happen. That's what I look back at with, you know, a little bit of you know, sentiment.
Yeah. You know mentality. What, Hovard, I really appreciate what you're saying, because I think right now there's lesson number one about what we can learn about how to do big things. Don't romanticize the project. It's the people that you care about. And then don't romanticize the actual work, because it's going to be hard, but it's worth it. So Hovard Grip and Teddy Zanetos, hang on for just a minute. I have so many more questions for you when we come back about what we, the rest of humankind, can learn from the remarkable successes of NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about what humanity can learn from the incredible successes of NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter, which ended its mission after suffering damage to at least one of its rotor blades in January. But that mission was almost 3 years long, and it was originally supposed to be merely 1 month long. So it shattered all expectations for what's possible regarding powered flight on Mars. I'm joined today by Hovard Grip. He's the chief pilot of the Ingenuity copter, and we're also joined by Teddy Zanetos. He's the project manager of Ingenuity and its team. So here's the thing that I want to spend a few minutes talking with both of you about and really learning deeply, because it's not just the imagery that Ingenuity sent back, which is remarkable, or the fact that it flew, but how this little copter was actually constructed. Because I didn't know until recently, and Teddy, I'll start with you here. It couldn't be that heavy, obviously, because it was positioned underneath the Perseverance rover, and there's always weight limitations on getting things to space. But NASA, the engineers used off-the-shelf components to build a Mars helicopter. Is that right, Teddy?
Correct. The fact that Ingenuity happened at all was really a confluence of a bunch of different things in the industry. Not just the fact that we had a one-of-a-kind team, an opportunity to launch to Mars with the Perseverance rover, Mars 2020, but a lot of it had to do with the technology of today. And when I say today, really, I mean of 2013, 2014. Ingenuity is powered by a cell phone chip. And that wouldn't have been possible back in the 90s when our chief engineer, Bob Ballard, originally started thinking about the idea. He sketched out the mathematics. It all made sense. But if you remember back in the 90s, cell phones were bigger than bricks,
yeah,
right? So you could not fly that 90s technology and still make an aircraft lightweight enough to fly at Mars. So when the opportunity presented itself, 2013, 2014, 2015, we were able to take cell phone chips, lithium ion battery technology, which is extremely energy dense, extremely power dense as well, and you can actually construct an aircraft that stands a chance at actually flying on Mars, which has, I'll remind everyone, 1% the density of Earth's atmosphere at sea level. So there's almost nothing, right? So you need all those bits to come together at the right time, and then you might stand a chance at actually flying to Mars.
Okay. I've grown old enough that few things are literally jaw-dropping to me anymore, but this is one of them, right? That I'm seeing here, it's a Qualcomm processor from what, roughly 2015, weighs half an ounce. So one can only imagine how many more orders of magnitude powerful current cell phone chips are. And you were able to also, you said the batteries, they were off the shelf, not developed specifically for NASA batteries that were able to withstand the insane temperature changes and launch and all the difficult environmental factors on Mars?
So, correct. And there's two reasons for that. Not only were off-the-shelf lithium batteries extremely high performance, we were effectively riding the wave of advancements from the industry for free, right? But the other aspect to that is the fact that Ingenuity was a tech demonstration. What a tech demo is for NASA is a high-risk, high-reward, low-budget mission. If it works, great. If it doesn't, it's okay. It doesn't have a core science objective. And that last part, the low budget, means that you couldn't go and invent a brand new battery purpose-built for Mars. You couldn't go and get a lightweight radiation-hardened processor for Mars. You were forced to use whatever you can get, right? So the vast majority of Ingenuity, we just went online and bought parts and made some good engineering judgments about what we thought would work. And then we also built the airframe with our partners at AeroVironment, all the carbon fiber, all, everything you see from the outside. That is, of course, custom. But what we're talking about are the electronics, the internals. A lot of that you could find in any university electronics lab around the country.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so on behalf of all mobile phone users out there, I'm going to ask right now if a cell phone battery or, sorry, a lithium battery can survive on Mars, why does my iPhone always go on strike when it gets too hot or too cold here on Earth? But maybe that's a question I'll turn to Apple here. But your point about being able to use off-the-shelf components to achieve such a remarkable mission is incredible. So, Hovard, let me turn to you. Tell me how, that design philosophy went into the flight control systems for Ingenuity.
Well, the off-the-shelf philosophy is also enabling for the flight controls because this type of vehicle, it's not like vehicles that you're used to operating in your daily life. It's not like your car. In particular, because a helicopter, it tends to be unstable. It doesn't want to stay right side up. It just wants to turn over and crash if you take your hands off the steering wheel, so to speak. So it requires a computer to stay on the ball constantly and constantly make minute adjustments to the controls just to stay right side up. So 500 times per second, you make minor controls adjustments. And even faster than that, we measure the motions of the vehicle using what's called an inertial measurement unit. It measures accelerations and angular rates. 3,200 times per second, we make those measurements. And 30 times per second, we take images of the ground and analyze those images for features, how they move across the field of view so that we can understand how the helicopter works. And being able to do that at such a rapid clip, it's just not something that's possible with the kind of hardware that you normally deploy for planetary exploration. This was only possible by aggressively leveraging commercial off-the-shelf technology that's been developed for cell phones or for drone technology in the commercial market.
Okay. So then in terms of its actual physical requirements for achieving flight, as Teddy mentioned, the Martian atmosphere is 1% as dense as sea level Earth atmosphere. And I guess the Earth-based equivalent would be trying to fly a helicopter at like 80,000 feet, which is just not possible, right? I was reading that most helicopters or even the specialty helicopters won't go above or even near 25,000 feet, which is why, let's say, Mount Everest rescues are very, very hard above a certain altitude. So what were the rotor blades made of, Hovard? And just tell me, what kind of thinking needed to go into actually just figuring out how do you get something to fly in 1% dense atmosphere?
Yeah, so the obvious thing when you say 1%, well, you think, well, it's difficult to produce enough thrust. And that is obviously true. And that was true from the start. But at the beginning, we were, maybe a little bit naive about things because that's the kind of the only thing we focused on up front. We thought, well, this is all about making the vehicle very light. And, we have to have a large enough rotor, spin it fast enough, we produce enough thrust. And that's true, but it's only part of the answer. What we discovered when we started trying to demonstrate the viability of this is that besides the lack of thrust in this atmosphere, It also changes in a fundamental way how the vehicle handles. Like it handles in a totally different way. Imagine that you're driving your car, but your steering wheel is attached to your front wheels via bungee cords. That's kind of what it's like if you try to build a helicopter for Mars the way you might build one for Earth. And that was a lesson that we had to learn. And it really kicked off an intensive effort to understand just the fundamentals of how a vehicle handles on Mars. And you mentioned the rotor blades. That was one of the solutions to that problem. The rotor blades on Ingenuity, they're kind of a work of art. They look substantial when you look at them, but if you try to lift one, it's light as a feather. Even I, when I lift one, I still kind of get surprised every time just by how light it feels. And having them be that light and simultaneously extremely stiff, that was one part of the solution to the handling challenges that we found with trying to fly in this thin atmosphere.
The whole weight of Ingenuity was about 4 pounds, right? So that's,
I don't know,
4 or 5 cans of soup at the maximum, just to get a sense as to how light it was. And when you talk about handling, I mean, it's not like you're getting real-time responsiveness because you had to wait hours and hours and hours for the flight commands to be sent to Ingenuity and then for Ingenuity to do its mission and then to send the results back. So I want to talk to you about that a little bit later, about how adjustments are made when there's that much delay. But Teddy, in the spirit of what can we learn from all that Ingenuity has taught, not just NASA or scientists or engineers, I mean, what do you think the big lesson is for just people listening right now when, you say that you used off-the-shelf components for a path-breaking planetary helicopter?
I see what this team has accomplished here, right, as a huge marker in the ground for all future aircraft development, spacecraft development, not just for Mars, the other outer planets, deep space in general. This is a huge victory to show all of humanity that, yes, we can build things in a different way, right? We don't need to do everything to the 9.99999% certainty, right? We can rely on more affordable technologies, and the way in which we develop those spacecraft, that is really a golden nugget of value that we've forged the path for here with Ingenuity.
Can I just jump in for a second, Teddy? And I'm sorry, I'll let you finish your thought in a second. So you mentioned Bob Balaram. It was originally his idea to look for off-the-shelf components. Is that right? Did I hear that correctly?
It was a team effort.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, the reason why I ask is because that moment seems to be very important, not just obviously from him, but for the team, that there was even this thought like, oh, maybe we can't do this using components specifically made for NASA. Let's look elsewhere. Like, what is it about the team that opened the door to that kind of thinking?
The willingness to take some risks is really what it boils down to, right? And not being scared to take those risks, not being scared to fail, pivot, fix it, and eventually you trust the system there. You trust that the team's going to make it through. We're here now after 2.5 years successful mission. There were a lot of small changes and small adjustments along the way during the development process where we tried things and they didn't work, right? We didn't have a manual to work from. No one had built a helicopter for Mars before. No one had tried using a cell phone chip before. We were writing the book along the way. So they were small and big engineering gambles. Some of them paid off. Some of them did not. And eventually we got a design that worked.
Wow. You know, I 100% predict that someone listening to this show right now, or at least I'm hoping, a young person listening to this show is going to go and buy a cell phone chip and some other off-the-shelf parts and see what they can do here on Earth. I had interrupted you because you were saying that this has a powerful impact on future missions, maybe missions even in development right now in terms of components that you can use and what you can hope to achieve. Right? So tell me more about
yes.
that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So NASA's working on another aircraft, the Dragonfly mission to Titan. And there are ways in which we're feeding lessons forward to that team and to that mission. But just to give the listeners at home here a sense of the magnitude, the processor on board Ingenuity and all of the processors combined, it is more than 100 times more powerful than everything we have sent out into deep space combined. Right, so when you take the Perseverance rover, the Curiosity rover, InSight, the Voyagers, for the Star Trek fans out there, V'ger, right? All of those missions, you combine all the computing power together, and Ingenuity is still 100 times more powerful than that. Right, that unlocks a lot of potential, not just in terms of what us aircraft nerds like focusing on, right, which is the aircraft performance and how fast we can fly, how high we can fly, but also for the scientists, right, and for other engineers that have interesting use cases. You can now use that resource out on another planet to do something that you maybe aren't thinking about today, but you may in the future. That's really enabling, I believe, for future missions.
Wow. You had to throw that Star Trek reference in there, Teddy. I'm trying so hard not to drag this conversation into references to, like, Carbon Unit Chakrabarty. I'll leave it at that. So, Hovard, then, similar question for you. In terms of the process that goes into designing, you know, flight control systems, et cetera, how do you see what you were able to, the team was able to achieve with Ingenuity influencing future missions?
Yeah, I think it has the potential to have a huge impact because we demonstrated some technologies that that proved to be extremely successful and an approach to developing those that is atypical. And as Teddy has mentioned, you know, the use of commercial off-the-shelf components, you know, as part of that, and then being able to leverage that to implement algorithms the way we did that really made use of that. And I'm talking in particular here, the visual inertial navigation system that was able to use those images at such a rapid clip, like I said, 30 times per second, analyzing images and navigating using that and seeing how successful that was. I can't but think that that is going to have an impact, a feed-forward impact on future missions.
Mm. I mean, it seems that it's going to definitely also have an impact on private space exploration, right? I mean, if you can be so successful with off-the-shelf components, does that, Hovard, let me stick with you. Do you think that opens the door even more to non-NASA missions?
Well, I would like to think that the entire community of you know, that is engaged in space exploration, you know, will look at this and take inspiration from it for sure.
And Teddy, what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I agree with Hovard. We've shown it's possible, right? The evidence is there, clear as day. There's 72 flights worth of data to back it up. And I encourage anyone who's got an idea out in space to you know, look at what the team has done here, look at the designs, and take what you can use and improve upon it.
Mm. Well, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take our next break here, Teddy. I mean, I want to talk more about what Ingenuity helped us discover about Mars itself. But if there's a – do you have a favorite image that the copter sent back?
My favorite image would probably be from Flight 13, Faiyefu. It's an outcrop called Faiyefu. And the scientists from the 2020 mission were interested to see – for the first time in our mission since we went into extended operations, could we go out and scout? And we generated this beautiful 3D image compositing multiple high-res shots. And it's really a perfect example of what you can do with that new aerial dimension in Mars.
Okay, so with that in mind, we're just going to take a quick break and talk a lot more about the doors that Ingenuity has opened in terms of humanity's exploration of space. So we'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter. It just ended its mission late last month after almost three years of spectacular flights on the Martian surface, which was 2 years and 11 months, basically longer, almost that time, that much amount of time, longer than it was supposed to last. A truly remarkable accomplishment. So today we're speaking with two members of the Ingenuity team to understand what we, the rest of humanity, can learn from that achievement. And I'm joined today by Teddy Zanetos. He's project manager of the Ingenuity Mars helicopter. And Hovard Grip is also with us. He's chief pilot of Ingenuity, and he led the development of its aerodynamics and flight control system. Before we get back to talking about the little copter that could specifically, I just want to hear from both of you a little bit of your stories. I mean, Hovard, let me start with you. Tell me a little bit about, you know, so your sort of your dreams as a kid and the path that led you to being part of a team that was the first to fly a helicopter on another planet.
Yeah, you know, looking back at, you know, when I was a kid, pretty much what I knew was I wanted to do something with computers. You know, that was really, it was pretty ill-defined, I would say. But it's also, you know, kind of what I ended up doing in some ways. I studied something called engineering cybernetics, which is sort of a fancy word for control theory. It's about writing algorithms to control different types of systems. I used that knowledge to work a little bit for the automotive industry. I spent a lot of time writing theorems and proofs, academic papers. And then eventually I ended up at JPL. And early on in my JPL career, in the first year, this Ingenuity project got started. And Bob Balaram, who was our chief engineer, he recruited me to lead the flight controls and aerodynamics portion of it, which is kind of crazy in a way, because I had no real background with helicopters. I hadn't really done anything with space even up to that point. But Bob thought this was a good bet, and I thank him for it. It was, you know, an incredible opportunity. And that's kind of how I got started. And I just started reading and learning and experimenting, and here we are. You know, we're 11 years out, and I can look back, and this is, you know, what's been defining for my career.
Wow. So Bob saw something in you that he was very confident was worth taking a chance on, and so glad he did it. I mean, Teddy, same question to you. What was your path that led you to being part of the Ingenuity team?
So the start of my nerdy journey, we're all a little bit nerds on this team.
No, right? You're kidding.
but it really goes back to when I was a little kid. My father, he had a business. He was making industrial sewing machines in New York. And I remember when I was a little kid, I was playing in the backyard with pneumatics, electronics. And I really wanted to understand how do these systems work? How do the mechanisms work? How does a computer do its thing? Back then, I just knew how to play Minesweeper. But that's when I got bit by the bug, so to speak, and really got that hunger inside of me to understand and disassemble things and put them back together. Went to school for engineering, computer science, electrical engineering. Worked for some research labs, DoD work. Started getting involved in drone work, and it was one Christmas I went home in New York. Went to a hobby shop and I bought myself my first helicopter. And I went to the hobby shop and he's like, you know how to fly this thing, right? I'm like, yeah. He's like, it's not for beginners. I'm like, yeah, no, it's fine. And I blew it up in my backyard. And I knew I was hooked. I was like, okay, I love this. Helicopters are amazing. And eventually I was lucky enough to get a job at NASA JPL. And when I first joined, I wasn't on the helicopter team. By then, Mimi, Bob, and Avard were about to start the engineering phase, engineering model phase, and I begged my boss at the time, you know, please introduce me to anyone on the heli team. I'd love to join up. And similar to Havard's story, you know, Bob gave me a shot. I met Bob, and I said, whatever you need, you know, I'm happy to do it. He said, there's some cables in a closet. We need someone to make some electrical ground support equipment, which you can think of as life support. It's a piece of equipment that's life support for your spacecraft. And things snowballed from there. Took on test conducting roles. We have what's called assembly test launch operations delivery to Kennedy Space Center. operations and now here at the end of the mission, leading the team. And it's been a remarkable journey, and we all are incredibly grateful to have had this shot to be, you know, any small part of it has been remarkable.
So we have to thank that that RC helicopter that you first.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure it blowing up was actually probably helped, but in terms of how cool is that? But so you know, there's this thirst to experiment and to try, and a high risk tolerance that I'm hearing in both of your stories here, which obviously comes in very handy when you're doing something that no one has ever done before. I mean, Teddy, like you said, there was no handbook for how to fly a helicopter on Mars. So obviously, there are probably countless challenges that the team faced, not just in the design and testing phase, but of course, while doing the 72 flights on Mars. So Hovard, let me ask you, were there times when or when those challenges popped up? How did the team go about, you know, solving them, especially when there was so much at stake, when the copter was actually, you know, on the Martian surface?
Well, you know, I think what distinguishes this team is that it's always extremely technical. You know, we don't, you know, screw around. We just get down to the nuts and bolts and the technical details. And also that's how the team reacted when those issues came up. You know, there's inevitably going to be curveballs that Mars throws at you, and we just went into the sort of technical mindset of figuring it out, staring at events from the helicopter, staring at telemetry, you know, trying to piece together the little scraps of information that we had in order to understand what went on, and that's been the case all along. And we had, you know, multiple challenges that we've worked through, and it's the case now that the mission has ended, but we're still talking to the helicopter, and we're still picking up little clues about what happened during our last flight on Mars.
Mm. Teddy, give us a specific example, because I think it was flight 52 that there were some communications problems. I mean, is that a good example of sort of the unexpected that happened and how the team solved it?
Yeah, we've had plenty of curveballs here on the ground before launch and in operations on Mars. I think Sol 426, and around when you're talking about, is when we first ran into winter on Mars. We designed Ingenuity to be a spring chicken, right? Survive 30 sols, that's it, in a warm spring environment. When we made it to our first winter, which was never designed to do, we knew that the energy balance was going to go in a trend that wasn't going to work out great for us. And eventually we got to the point where we lost contact with the baby. We woke up here on Earth and went into work, and we said, all right, what data do we have today? And there was none. And that's an example of really when the team, you know, put on its game face. We got into a small, you know, 10 by 10 conference room where we can all, you know, look each other in the eyes and try and piece together from physics first principles. That is a huge tenet here of start with the physics and work your way from there in terms of understanding what happened. And that's what we did. We looked at the solar installation, how much energy was coming from the sun's rays, models and predictions of the environment. How windy was it the night before? How cold was it the night before? And using those bits of information and the math behind it, we were able to come up with a theory. And then we made a test to see if the theory was correct. We uplinked that to the surface of Mars, and over the course of 2 days, we were able to what we call recapture the helicopter and communicate, reset clocks, reset alarm clocks, and that's why we were able to continue the mission for as long as we did. So that physics first principles is a huge part of everything that the team embodies, but especially in those curveball moments, it's important to keep your wits about you and keep the emotions down and just focus on what you know. And keep in mind what you don't know.
Yeah. So you kept referring to sols as in Earth days, right? Because the Martian year is so much longer, right, than an Earth year. But that brings to mind, and Hovard, I had meant to ask you this earlier, about the fact that you are communicating with a helicopter that's 100 plus 140-ish million miles away, and the and the time to get commands to Ingenuity and back, that round trip is like, what, 6-ish hours? Is that right?
It varies depending on how, you know, Earth and Mars are positioned.
Their relative positions.
But it's always, you know, it's always, and when we talk about hours here, we're really talking about the time that it takes, not just for the light or the radio signals to travel between Earth and Mars, but also the time that it takes to relay that information through multiple points.
Okay. So that means that there are many, many hours of essentially no communication, right? There's just like a huge period of time of uncertainty. Tell us about like how the team figured out like what kind of flight do we want to ask Ingenuity to do? And then I just presume that those commands are sent to the copter. But how did you decide in advance what you wanted the copter to do?
Yeah, so when it comes to controlling a helicopter on Mars, I think of it as sort of a two-stage process. One is you got to write algorithms that lives on board the helicopter that gives the helicopter the ability to make those minor adjustments during flight, thousands and thousands of them. And that allows it to stay upright during the flight. So those are algorithms that live on board the helicopter and makes all of those tiny little decisions in real time. But then the big decisions about flying, those we reserve for us on Earth that are operating a helicopter. And so we look at maps, we look at the weather, we look at the terrain in the area, and we make those decisions about, you know, where is it safe for the helicopter to fly. And part of that process is also experimenting with it on Earth. And when I say experimenting here, I'm talking about using simulations. So we have some fairly sophisticated computer simulations that we built up for Ingenuity that we use to try out things on Earth before we uplink it to Ingenuity. But at the end of that process, we upload a sequence that tells Ingenuity exactly what to do, down to every single maneuver that it's going to do. It's going to spin up to the rotors to a certain speed. It's going to take off. It's going to accelerate a certain rate, climb to a certain altitude, and so on and so forth. All of those decisions are made here, but then it's up to Ingenuity to execute that and tell us afterwards how it went.
Huh. Well, we've only got a few minutes left, unfortunately, in this conversation, and I kind of want to end with this again in the spirit of like what can we all learn, because I don't know, I think Ingenuity's success has come at a very, very, very good time for this country and for people as a whole, because you look left and you look right and you see groups not being able to work together to get big things done. I mean, obviously I'm thinking of politically, most obviously, but in Ars Technica, their senior space editor Eric Berger recently wrote a story, and Teddy, you're actually quoted in it. But here's how he ends his story. He says, "This is Eric's writing." He said, "I have naturally become a little jaded over time as I have watched NASA and other space agencies around the world take two steps forward and one step back. Space is hard. Battling through bureaucracy is hard. There's a lot of BS out there in the space industry," he said. But then he says, "But the launch deployment and astonishing performance of Ingenuity during the last 3 years has truly taken my breath away. It is a phenomenal engineering achievement and a real triumph of the engineers over some NASA management who never wanted Ingenuity to fly. As Americans, as humans, we can all be proud to witness flight on another world." So, Teddy, do you think the kind of accomplishment over bureaucracy, and there's always politics in bureaucracy, that can you do you feel hopeful that can happen outside the context of a Mars helicopter?
I do, and I feel like I would expand it beyond just, you know, there's always going to be bureaucracy. But even within teams and outside of teams, really trying to break free from molds, right? And to be okay with some discomfort about, well, what did the previous generation do, right? And why? Understanding why, and being okay with taking some risks and changing it, right? That was a big part of changing the mentality of our own team, right? Because there's never been an example of how do you fly a helicopter on another planet? How do you build a helicopter for another planet? How do you even test a helicopter for another planet? We had to break a lot of rules. And we call them flight project practices and design principles. The DPs are not written yet for the next helicopter. And we're working on that. but that's part of, you know, getting through not just political bureaucracy, but organizational bureaucracy. And do not take rules for granted. Always challenge and understand, again, back to the physics, why were they written in the first place? And do you agree with them? And if you don't, be willing to fight.
That is incredible. Well, you know, unfortunately, we're out of time. And so I can't thank both of you enough for that little 4-pound masterpiece. And everyone else, by the way, who was part of the who was and is part of the Ingenuity team. Just congratulations again on proving to us that humanity still can do really big and hard things. Teddy Zanetos, project manager of the NASA Ingenuity Mars helicopter, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Hovard Grip, chief pilot of Ingenuity, who also led the development of its aerodynamics and flight control system. Hovard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.